Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm Alexis Strauss Hacker, Chair of the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board. I welcome you to today's board meeting. We appreciate your patience today as we work in our temporary location, familiar to many of you for other meetings. If any issues come up, please see our board clerk at the back of the room. We'll call the roll for our board members momentarily, but first, some logistics. Today's meeting is hybrid, so in addition to in-person participants that we may have here in the conference room, we may also receive public comment through our Zoom meeting platform. If you are remote and intend to comment, you need to be in the Zoom meeting space and not watching through the webcast. If you haven't already received a link for the Zoom meeting, you can visit our website and register. A link will be sent after registering. If you're here in person and wish to speak, please register online or with assistance from our team at the registration table near the entry door. For those in the Zoom meeting, you'll be muted until it's your turn to speak. Our staff will then promote you, and you'll need to unmute yourself on the Zoom platform or your phone so that we can hear you. When you're done speaking and the board members have completed asking any questions they may have, you'll be placed back on mute. For those in the room here and waiting to speak, you'll be called by name when it's your turn. Please make your way up here to the podium so that we can better see and hear you. All speakers have 3 minutes for comment. We ask you state your name and your affiliate organization, if applicable, when called upon. Thank you for joining us today. We look forward to a good meeting, and I'd like to ask Julie Haas, our clerk for the board, to call the roll.
There we go. Good morning, everyone. Board Member Ransom.
Here.
Board Member Beelan.
Here.
Board Member Gunther.
Here.
Board Member Batty.
Here.
We have Board Member Kissinger. Him online. All right. Vice Chair Young.
Here.
And Chair Hacker.
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a quorum physically present for today's meeting and welcome everyone. Next on our agenda is public forum. I'd like to open our meeting to the public forum. I want to remind everyone that the public forum is for items not on the agenda today and that are neither a pending nor an impending matter, meaning they're not about to come up on our agenda in the next several months. Commenters are welcome to speak on agenda items at the appropriate time during the meeting. Please consult our board clerk, Julie Haas, who's seated in the front of the room, if you have any questions. I'll call on each of our public speakers who have registered to speak. One additional note, if you are remote and haven't been called, please raise your virtual hand on the Zoom platform by clicking on the reactions icon on your screen and then on the raise hand icon. That way we'll know to call on you. Again, each speaker is allowed 3 minutes and will be timed and notified using the online timer visible on the screen. Thank you for your understanding. Whom do we have registered to speak?
We have no public registrations at this point.
Is there anyone in the room who wishes to make comment? And if not, we're going to move on. Public registrations may come in, and if so, we'll deal with them at the appropriate time. Public forum is now closed. We'll proceed with review of the previous board meeting minutes from March and April. Included in our board meeting packets and posted online are the draft minutes from our March 13th, 2024 board meeting. I want to note one minor change to the March 13 meeting minutes. Uncontested NPDES permits in number 5, we would modify the word commenters to comments. It's just a minor wording change. But does anyone have any other edits or revisions to these minutes? Seeing none, I'd like to ask for a motion and a second to adopt the March board meeting minutes.
Move to approve.
Second.
Julie, would you please call the roll?
Board Member Ransom.
Yes.
Board Member Beelan.
Yes.
Board Member Gunther.
Yes.
Board Member Batty?
Yes.
Board Member Kissinger is having trouble getting logged in. Vice Chair Young?
Yes.
And Chair Hacker?
Yes. Thank you. The March 13th, 2024 board meeting minutes have been adopted by the board. Next item is item 4, the minutes of our April 10th board meeting. Included in our board meeting packets and posted online are the draft minutes from our April 10th offsite board meeting. Are there any edits or revisions to these minutes? And seeing none, I'd like to ask for a motion and a second to adopt the April board meeting minutes.
So moved.
Second.
Julie, would you please call the roll?
Getting used to this microphone here. Board Member Ransom?
Yes.
Board Member Beelan?
Yes.
Board Member Gunther?
Yes.
Board Member Batty?
Aye.
Vice Chair Young?
Aye.
And Chair Hacker?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you. The April 10th board meeting minutes have been adopted by the board. It was wonderful to have had the field trip board meeting that we did. And thank you again to all of you who helped make that happen. I think it was very well received. It was a lovely day. Right. Item 5, which are board members and executive officer reports. Let's see. I'm going to just move in our new setup in this conference room and ask Board Member Beelan if she has anything to report.
No, not right now.
Board Member Batty?
I'm just going to make a quick report out about the status of the beach in Miramar in San Mateo County. I took a walk there yesterday, and Julie, I apologize. I meant to send you some photos, but didn't get to. Anybody that's familiar with that coastline between Princeton Harbor down to, let's see, where would it be, down to Miramar Drive area, it's about maybe a mile stretch, but the beach is quickly eroding, and the road in front of the Miramar Beach Inn, which also has several hotels, or has a couple of hotels, has a restaurant, and some housing, it is now a one-way road, because after years of throwing riprap into the seawall, the county has now said that we have to move this to a one-way road. It's quite dramatic, and even since they put the, what do you call them, the markers up, the stakes up, the road, you know, very physical. Keith, what are they called? I forget. They are now falling also into the ocean, and that's only months since they've been installed, probably. So it's really interesting to see it happening right before our eyes.
Sobering. I want to acknowledge and welcome Board Member Kissinger. I'm glad we were able to connect. Bill, do you have anything you'd like to report? Unmute.
Much. Good morning. Thank you. No, I don't have anything to report.
Thanks. Good to see you. Board Member Gunther.
Yeah, I have something to bring to everyone's attention from the BCDC meeting, and it follows right along with what Board Member Batty had to say. We had a presentation from Dr. Ben Hamlington, who is a scientist at JPL who's involved with NASA in producing sea level rise estimates for the Ocean Protection Council. These are ones the state officially uses. And 15, 20 years ago, it became clear that there is evidence in our paleontological record of the ocean rising faster than our models were able to produce. And this led to research and hypothesizing about mechanisms by which the ocean could rise that quickly, one of being a group that are characterized as ice sheet instability, the idea that the ice sheets don't just melt, but they can various ways fall apart into the ocean, raising sea levels much faster. And and this led the California Ocean Protection Council to produce a sea level rise scenario in their 2017 report, Rising Seas, called H++. Some might be familiar with it, that had 8 to 10 feet of sea level rise in the California by 2100. And it wasn't there because it was likely, but it was there because it was plausible. And in Dr. Hamlington's recent presentation, we learned that H++ has been revised down So instead of this scenario having 8 to 10 feet of sea level rise by 2100, it's more like 5 to 6 feet. This has some enormous implications. Among others is that the wetlands restoration we do now will be paying benefits for many, many, many more decades than we originally thought, making them much more valuable, making all of our resilience efforts much more valuable before they were overwhelmed by sea level rise. I'm in communicating with Dr. Hamilton, and maybe next month I'll have some more answers for you. But there is a note that I want to make sure people understand, which is that there are some serious questions about whether we do have the science right about ice sheet instability. Dr. Hamilton said that what they have determined is that because we are no longer on track for a 5-degree future, or even 4 degrees, but more like 3 by 2100, a global average temperature increase, that it does not appear from the models NASA is using that that will trigger ice sheet instability. But I happen to have colleagues who are engaged in this issue, and in speaking to them, I have come to the conclusion myself that we don't know yet, and that there are things, for example, how does Antarctica respond when all that fresh water enters the Southern Ocean? Does that feed back and make the ice sheet more unstable? These are the kinds of things we don't yet have in our models. And we also know that our models still are struggling to reproduce what we are observing now, like the ice loss in Greenland. The mass of the ice sheet is declining faster. So there's still uncertainty there. But this was actually like some remarkable good news, given the bad news the ocean has been delivering to us over the last year in terms of temperature, that there may be reason to hope that sea level will rise a little more slowly, even though its eventual height is going to be the same, that would have remarkable impacts on our ability to build a resilient shoreline in the Bay Area.
Is there a connection, as you say, to OPC issuing its, when does OPC next issue its?
I don't know exactly, but I do know that what we were being presented with is the scientific projections that are behind OPC's efforts. So I would imagine that we'll see this soon. But the key point that Dr. Hamilton made was that it's not that that scenario is no longer part of our calculus, it's that it has actually come down. And the whole range, particularly if you look out to 2050, the projected range of sea level rise is smaller than it was 7 years ago. We're getting a better handle on it. But I just had to bring forward the concerns that my colleague Ben Santer and others who are looking at this have raised about the fact that we don't know yet. And we think there's a lot we know we don't know. So I'm not going to quote Donald Rumsfeld, but that's the that's kind of where we're at. So I mean, we'll know more in the next 5 years for sure. But this was a surprisingly profound presentation for, you know, particularly for our work as well.
Thank you, Board Member Ransom.
Nothing to report.
Vice Chair Young.
Thank you. Just quickly for ABAG, there's nothing significant to report from the last meeting. There is discussions about housing, affordable housing, and implementation, but no direct conversations about on-site bioretention or things that I think would be important to us. So I'll continue updating the team as I go to those meetings, which are always a little bit late, but you know, what can you do there? And then secondly, I've mentioned a couple of times about Ocean Conservancy that may not directly affect us, but obviously storm runoff, sewer, things like that affect, and of course climate change are affecting our local oceans in many ways. The giant kelp restoration project I've been following is a very interesting community effort that is meant to address sort of the loss of sea otters, the rise in sea urchins, and of course the death of the kelp. And they worked over the last few years to restore about 11 acres of kelp in the Monterey Bay, which is really great. But now comes the hard work. They must work with California Department of Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife, excuse me, to determine if that's really sustainable or how they would go forward. But it's very interesting that the community has sort of taken that active effort to provide sort of the test case, if you will, to see what could work sort of physically. And then similar to what our field trip showed last month, finding the real solutions that are, you know, much less intensive in terms of effort to maintain is sort of the most important balance for us. So hopefully you guys will see something with California Fish and Wildlife and some of those organizations. I do know that the North Bay has an active group as well, and I believe others are sort of beginning to perform sort of similar discussions in other places along the coast. So I'll continue monitoring that. It's one of my little hobbies. That's all. Thanks.
Maybe we could have a informational item they would present sometime.
Thanks.
I just have a couple things to mention. First, this being Public Service Recognition Week nationwide, I wanted to acknowledge our colleagues here in the room and throughout the organization and how much we appreciate your dedication to the work that this regional board does and to all the regional boards across the state, to state board and to our wonderful council present. So thank you all for a continuing commitment to public service. It's so important to have meaningful work, and I feel that what you do every day and how it manifests itself in our board meetings is a very important representation of that. I'm also very grateful that we continue to have hybrid meetings so that we can reach people who don't necessarily come in person, who can then be made aware of the work that we're doing and the work that's coming up. So thank you very much. Since we last met with our executive officer, Eileen White, I had a brief meeting with a representative of the home building industry who had expressed concerns with regard to an element of the stormwater permit. And I think that we just very briefly explained that in any permitting scenario, particularly NPDES, Clean Water Act based permitting, that anti-backsliding provisions are terribly important. And where there may be a misunderstanding of how that provision in the statute is interpreted and how it's carried forward in Porter Cologne as well, we suggested that their attorneys and our attorneys talk further. So I just wanted to mention that brief discussion that we had with no further action at this time. Those are the main things that I could mention at this point, and I'd like to turn to Eileen White for her report. I always really enjoy preparing for this meeting and looking at the executive officer's report. I'm very, there's just a lot of useful detail in there, and part of that, I just wanted to welcome back a colleague from the regional board who has returned, David Elias. So with that, Eileen.
Great. Thank you so much. I wanted to highlight a few things from the executive officer's report. First, I want to highlight the great collaboration between our team at the Water Board and the City of Oakland and the Lake Merritt Institute. We're all working together to monitor Lake Merritt and try to prevent the massive, you know, fish kills that we saw in August and September of 2022. We had some, quote, look like potential algae blooms this past spring, and the team just mobilized very quickly to go out and sample, work with our partners at the Department of Public Health. So I just want to recognize the ongoing collaboration as they work together to pilot scale some oxygenation systems and surface. We'll be continuing to work with them and providing them technical support through a contract with SFEI. Also, later this morning, you're going to be hearing a presentation on the updated strategic work plan. And as you know, advancing racial equity and environmental justice is one of our organizational priorities. And in this month's executive officer's report, we wanted to share one example of our community engagement with all positives possible. And it's a grassroots nonprofit organization based in Richmond with the goal of supporting low-income disadvantaged communities and promoting positive community environmental health. Our team here has been engaging with all positive positives on various environmental and regulatory topics, developing those working relationships, introducing them to agency contacts at other agencies. It's very confusing to the public what the Water Board does, Department of Public Health, State Board, just all the various agencies. So providing clarity, providing them information about grant applications, and empowering them to share updates and outreach within their community. We continue the Water Board to prioritize community engagement through outreach and collaboration with communities like All Positives Possible. Another example is last week, we submitted our comments to the U.S. Navy on their draft fifth five-year review report for the Hunters Point Naval Shipyard. Tomorrow, a few of us will be attending a community meeting with EPA and the Department of Toxic Substances at the Southeast Community Center in San Francisco with the goal of hearing concerns from the public on the Navy's report. And we'll provide an update in a future executive officer's report. And then to build on Board Member Batty's and Dr. Gunther's comments about climate change, I just want to let you know that you're all aware that another one of our organizational priorities is addressing climate change. And I want to thank Board Members Batty and Board Member Gunther for their participation in developing a memorandum of understanding with the goal of coordinating our efforts in the Bay Area to address the threats of flooding and sea level rise among the Bay Area Regional Collaborative and its member agencies. The MOU was just finalized, and over the next month, it will be signed by the Association of Bay Area Governments, the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, California Department of Transportation District 4, the California State Coastal Conservancy, the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and last but not least, by the San Francisco Bay Water Board. So I just want to say we're going to continue our collaboration with our Bay Area partners as we try to address climate change. We know climate change is a regional problem, and it needs a regional solution, and we all need to work together on it in the Bay Area. And that concludes my highlights.
Thank you. Are there any comments for our executive officer, Dr. Gunther?
Yeah, I just want everyone to recognize that the MOU looked one way before our talented executive officer got their hands on it, and then it got totally straightened out and is a much more effectively presented document because of Eileen's input.
Any other comments or questions?
I had one question about the executive reporter.
Go ahead, Bill.
So to Eileen, with regard to Lake Merritt and the efforts to put in place infrastructure to help with the oxygenation of the water to deal with the algae bloom. I was curious, doesn't that in effect feed the algae bloom that much more? How does that necessarily, I guess I understand how it helps prevent the fish kill, but doesn't it also propagate the algae bloom as well?
No, what the goal is of the oxygenation system. So what happened with the harmful algae bloom in 2022 is we believe it was mostly that the harmful algae bloom dropped the dissolved oxygen to below what we want in the basin plan. It's a goal of 5 milligrams per liter. It dropped to zero throughout Lake Merritt, through parts of San Francisco Bay. And so that was the primary cause, we think, of the fish kills. We also think there may be a toxin that harmful algae releases that also causes fish kills, but we think the primary, we monitored the dissolved oxygen levels, and throughout Lake Merritt and San Francisco Bay, it dropped below our goal of 5 milligrams per liter. With these oxygenation systems, the goal is that it will keep the oxygen above 10 milligrams per liter, so you wouldn't have the fish dying off because they couldn't breathe. And having run around that lake for 25 years, I did see, it was really sad to see literally fish gasping for breath in August of 2022. They were coming up for air trying to get oxygen. So the goal with these oxygenation systems is that it will keep the oxygen to levels where the fish will not impact fish.
No, I understand that. I assume the algae also needs the oxygen, and they're consuming it, you know, in combination with the nutrients. But I guess the answer is
temperature and nutrient concentrations are more limiting to algal growth than oxygen concentrations, yes, is my understanding.
That's correct. Thank you. Dr. Gunther.
Anything further? Bill, anything further?
No, nothing further. Thank you.
All right. I'd like to move on with the remaining board items. I'd like to administer the oath for today's hearing. All relevant evidence that any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, second by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested parties. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witness by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rules of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that's reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibits, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this process. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise or raise their hand. You promise to tell the truth? Thank you. And now, Eileen, will you continue with board item six?
Yes, thank you. So Ora Loma and Castro Valley Sanitary Districts own a wastewater treatment plant that serves about 192,000 people in the San Lorenzo and Castro Valley area. And they primarily discharge through the East Bay dischargers known as EBDA, common outfall. But sometimes when we get these excessive storms, they have to discharge from a shallow water outfall during the peak wet weather events when the effluent flow exceeds their allotted capacity for the EBDA common outfall, because there's multiple agencies that use the EBDA outfall. So this tentative order would reissue the MPDS permit for the Ora Loma and Castro Valley Sanitary Districts to discharge through the shallow water outfall to lower San Francisco Bay during the peak wet weather events and occasionally during the dry season for maintenance purpose. This tentative order incorporates the updated requirements, included updating effluent limitations for ammonia, chlorine, and bacteria. We did not receive any comments on this tentative order, and staff are available to answer any questions.
Do any board members have questions or comments with regard to this permit reissuance? Okay, I'd like to open the forum for public comments. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to comment? I appreciate that the manager of Ora Loma Sanitary District has joined us. And is there anyone online that wishes to comment? All right. Back to our executive officer. Do you have a recommendation in this regard?
Yes, thank you. We recommend the board approve the reissuance of the MPDS permit for the Ora Loma and Castro Valley Sanitary Districts.
May I please have a motion and a second to approve the reissuance of this MPDS permit?
So moved. Second.
Very well. Julie, could you please call the roll?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Beelen.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Batty.
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Young.
Aye.
And Chair Hacker.
Aye.
Thank you.
Very well. I'd like to thank the discharger, and I'd like to thank our staff, the permit writer, Natalie Lee, and the management team for the work done to reissue this permit. Thank you so much. Very well. Eileen, I think we're ready to proceed with informational item seven, the strategic work plan.
Great. We'll pull up the presentation. And as we're pulling up the presentation, I'll just introduce it that I'm really pleased to present our update to the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board strategic work plan. The development of the work plan last year and this update was a collaborative effort across our leadership team. Together, we worked on the preparation of the plan, and all of us are responsible for implementing the goals and priorities outlined in the plan. The strategic work plan reflects our shared values and passion for serving the public and protecting the Bay Area's water resources. I'd like to recognize Clee Carlton, engineer and geologist with the Water Board, who provided the photo for this year's updated strategic work plan. Also, Maggie Monahan, Senior Water Resource Engineer, and Demir Worthington, Engineering Geologist, were instrumental working with me and the leadership team to plan, organize, and update the strategic work plan. Next slide, Maggie, please. Great. In March of 2023, we introduced our strategic work plan that covered fiscal years 23 and 24. The strategic work plan was developed to provide an overview of what we do and to create transparency about our work to the public we serve. It describes our organizational priorities and the water quality programs we implement every day to achieve our mission. As we envisioned, over the past year, we've utilized the strategic work plan in our engagements with various community organizations to advance our racial equity and environmental justice actions. We've also used it to attract, retain, and engage a talented, diverse, and inclusive workforce in support of our mission. The strategic work plan is dynamic, enabling us to respond to future challenges and changing priorities, like the fish kills that occurred in August of 2022. We committed to use the work plan to report out our yearly achievements, which we did in September of last year for fiscal year 23. And we also are committed to update it on a biannual basis, which is what we're doing today. I'm now going to turn it over to Maggie, who will present the strategic work plan and discuss the updates. Thank you, Maggie.
Thanks, Eileen. So these next few slides are going to go over the core of our strategic work plan and the basic contents. This will provide a high-level intro to the work plan. So starting with our mission, shown on this slide, our mission guides all that we do. And part of our workforce culture is that we are mission-driven. Staff believe in the mission, and we are all very passionate about protecting water quality. We're also dedicated to serving the public as we work to achieve our mission. To protect water quality, we determine the different water uses for each water body in our region, known as beneficial uses, and work to ensure that the water quality conditions can support those beneficial uses, such as the pictures on this slide: fishing, drinking water, agricultural use, recreation, wildlife, shellfish harvesting, and more. We serve the public by building trust and long-term relationships through proactive communication, education, and collaboration. And we strive to consistently provide professional, high quality, and timely service to the public. Collaboration is key to our success because of the range of water quality challenges we work on and the extensive and diverse nature of our stakeholder community. We actively participate with local, state, and national regulatory agencies, publicly owned treatment works, professional organizations, cities, counties, and academic and other science institutions to protect water quality. Some examples of the stakeholders we collaborate with at the local level are shown on this slide. And some examples at the state and national levels are shown here, including the State Water Board and the California Environmental Protection Agency and its departments, such as the Department of Toxic Substances Control and the Department of Pesticide Regulation, as well as the US EPA and many others. So the strategic work plan covers who we are, providing an overview of the water boards, our mission and our organizational priorities, what we do with brief descriptions of each of our water quality programs, our priorities, both organizational priorities and program priorities with associated targets and milestones, and our performance measures and targets. And the map on this slide shows our regional boundary in black, which is based on watersheds. The colored lines show streams or coastlines. And as you can see, our region runs from the North Bay wine country to Silicon Valley and from the Altamont Pass to the Pacific Ocean. This biannual update is for fiscal years 2025 and 2026. The scope of the update was focused on updating our priorities, targets, and milestones. The table of contents is shown here. Most of the content remains the same, as our mission and what we do have not changed. Our program targets and milestones now reflect the next two fiscal years. And you'll notice a few other updates, including the letter from our executive officer, some minor updates to program descriptions, and a few additional photos to showcase our work, as well as the updated feature cover photo that Eileen mentioned. Our key organizational priorities remain unchanged, and these include implementing climate actions, advancing racial equity and environmental justice, and advancing our workforce planning and development. The work plan organizes our water quality programs under four categories shown here: plan and assess, regulate, clean up, and enforce. Plan and assess encompasses our basin planning program, integrated report and total maximum daily loads, and the surface water ambient monitoring program, and other planning level and policy development initiatives. The regulate category is broad. This includes regulation of discharges of pollutants that threaten the quality of the state's waters. So our wastewater discharge programs, recycled water program, stormwater programs, dredge and fill, land disposal, agricultural lands, all are housed in this category. Cleanup is around the oversight of contaminated sites. And sites can be contaminated from a variety of sources, such as former industrial activities, leaking underground petroleum tanks, chemical spills, or other leaks. And enforce is around our enforcement activities of the requirements established for discharges and contaminated sites. Our goal is always to achieve compliance to protect water quality, and we may take enforcement actions of various types and levels of stringency to achieve that. And the pictures on this slide represent some of the many programs in each of the categories. So if you're still wondering what exactly it is that we do, this by the numbers table is intended to help. The work plan includes the table shown on this slide. This is by no means a comprehensive listing of our work, but it gives a sense of the scope of our work, at least for some of our programs. So beginning at the top, it shows the number of water quality certifications that we typically issue per year, and then the number of NPDES permits and recycled water programs. Following that, the numbers of various types of regulated facilities or sites: industrial, construction, landfills, and cleanup cases. So the work plan describes what we do, including brief descriptions of the programs in each category, and then the work plan presents our organizational priorities and our program priorities with associated targets and milestones in table format. We have performance measures and targets around many of the items listed in this table. The performance measures were selected because they're broad indicators of performance. For example, we have targets for the cleanup program for cases closed, which are indicators that exposure to pollution is stopped. We are outcome-oriented, focusing on the intended outcome and not just about hitting numbers. We do our work in a meaningful way to protect and improve water quality while also addressing climate change risks and environmental racism and environmental injustice. So with that, I'm going to go back to our organizational priorities in order to highlight some of our program targets and milestones included in this biannual update. Starting with climate action, we continue to incorporate climate actions into our program activities to utilize our authority to advance climate adaptation planning, coordination, technical assistance, and permitting. As Eileen mentioned, we're very pleased with the MOU on coordination efforts among the Bay Area Regional Collaborative and its member agencies. As climate change impacts touch everything we do, specific actions and targets around climate action are included in the programs. I'll provide some examples that are in our updated work plan here. In our basin planning program, one of our priority actions is to develop climate change and riparian area protection policy. For wastewater and flood management infrastructure renewal, our priority is to ensure climate change resiliency in wastewater infrastructure renewal projects. In the municipal stormwater program, a priority is to support municipal implementation of multi-benefit green stormwater infrastructure designs that not only address polluted runoff, but also achieve co-benefits, including climate change and water supply resilience. And in the site cleanup and underground storage tank programs, we address potential adverse impacts from sea level rise and groundwater rise by requiring vulnerability assessments. And you'll hear a bit more about this in the next informational item today, the site cleanup program update. So these are just some of the examples of what we're doing around climate change actions and how we're implementing. Next, on racial equity, and environmental justice. Last September, we introduced our Racial Equity and Environmental Justice Action Plan. The action plan describes both our current and ongoing actions and plan next steps. The plan's focus is communities experiencing environmental racism or environmental injustice. The action plan first describes actions that are being completed office-wide, as shown on the slide: relationship building, work prioritizing, and workforce development, followed by actions taken in each of the four work plan categories. We aim to build and sustain relationships with environmental justice communities and prioritize water quality issues that are affecting those communities. And Eileen gave a few examples of that at the beginning. We're also focused on our staff, both our staff's educational backgrounds and lived experience to inform our actions, and the training that we can offer to ensure all staff have an understanding of environmental injustice and the approaches to address it. Many specific actions and targets around this organizational priority are also included within the programs, and I'll again provide a few examples that are included in the updated work plan. Again, starting with basin planning program, one of our priority actions is to designate tribal tradition and culture and tribal subsistence fishing and beneficial uses in the basin plan. In our surface water ambient monitoring program, we continue key monitoring and education outreach with underrepresented communities. And in our site cleanup and underground storage tank programs, we apply environmental justice lens to inform cleanup priorities. And again, you'll be hearing a little bit more about this in the next info item. So that concludes my overview of the strategic work plan and a few highlights of what's inside this update. Again, our focus was to update the tables with our priority actions, targets, and milestones for the next two fiscal years. New program priorities that implement our organizational priorities are included in this update, including the examples I had shared. We invite you to review the plan to see the full detail and scope of our work. We plan to finalize this update and then post it to our website and begin its implementation in the next fiscal year, next month. We track our progress throughout the year, and we bring many major milestones to the board throughout the year. And as was done last September, we'll be back again towards the end of this calendar year to report to the board on the outcomes for this fiscal year. And we'll also continue to use this work plan for community outreach and recruitment efforts. And with that, I'll turn it back to Eileen to close.
Thank you, Maggie. In closing, the strategic work plan is a roadmap that guides us in achieving our mission. And I just want to recognize the talented team of engineers, environmental scientists, geologists, and attorneys that we have that work every day to serve the public and protect our water quality. And just want to say in closing that really the diversity of the Water Board team really adds to the richness of the organization and to what we can achieve and also what we can deliver to the public. And I look forward to reporting out later this year, as Maggie said. And in closing, I just want to thank the board for your support as we work together to achieve our mission. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I open this up for board member comments and any questions for Maggie, Eileen, and the like. Go ahead, board member Gunther.
One specific question. I think it's so spectacular to see these performance measures and targets and the way that you guys are making us all accountable to get something done. That's really important. I'm confused about why in the table on page 41, there are no FY24-25 targets for cleanup. I know we're working on it.
Right. So the my understanding of that answer, Board Member Gunther, is that we're waiting on those targets from State Board, and they'll come out this summer, I believe.
And then we'll put them in.
So before we release this, there'll be something there.
Yeah, so what we wanted to do, it seems funny to tell you after the fact when the fiscal year started that this is what we're going to do. So our goal in coming to you today in May was telling you what our look ahead for the next 2 years is. State Board runs a little they're a little further behind. And so once we get them, we will input them in. And this is a living document that's going to be on a website anyway. So as soon as we get the targets from the state, they will be incorporated and added to our website version.
Okay. I just think if we're going to distribute this, at least put a little asterisk there that says waiting for state board action, because otherwise it kind of looks like we ain't doing bookus, but
good point.
Okay. I'm interested, this is the first update,
yes.
Is that right?
Okay. Yes, it's the first update.
So has having the plan, I can definitely see how having the plan has this outward facing impact. But I'm also wondering whether the process of updating the plan was valuable internally as well. Just thinking about what we're doing and how we're doing it. And I mean, is that also helpful, or is this mainly an outward facing exercise?
I would say it's both. It's for us to reflect, you know, we're public servants and what are we trying to achieve in a given fiscal year? So I think it's important both internally and externally that we know, and some of them like the state board targets they already had, but as you see on page 41 is where the state board targets are. That's a snapshot of what we do. There's so much work that we do that's not captured in those, you know, quote, as my staff would say, bean counting that they do. You know, how many MPDS inspections does Bill Johnson and his team conduct? How many permits? But there's all this other work that we do at the Water Board. And so that's what we're trying to capture. And as we hire new people, we want to be able to convey to them, this is the work we do. And also just for our own staff that they know, whether you're in a particular division or section, what your group is responsible for, but also knowing what other groups do. The other thing, I think this has been great, I got from one of our later speakers today, Kimberly, last year when this came out, she sent me an email that night when I distributed it to all the staff saying, I didn't know about some of the work we did. And I don't know how many years Kim's been with the Water Board, Kimberly, but she's like, Eileen, I've learned about programs I didn't know about. So I think it's both internal and external.
Okay, yeah, that's great. And I want to make it clear, I don't consider the height of the beans in the jar as the important target for us to hit.
Right.
But we do need to have some beans in the jar every year.
Yeah. And I'll just add, as a section leader, first line supervisor, we were already creating work plans like before we published it. But you know, through this effort, it made us, you know, think harder of like, what are we going to commit publicly to? Like, you know, our internal work plans might have a little more detail, stretch goals. So this helped to like really focus on what are our true priorities.
Board Member Batty and then Board Member Ransom.
Morning, everybody. I just want to say, first of all, love this. I mean, the clarity, the ambition in it, really communicating the scope of the work. And I love the intentionality. So thank you, Eileen, and thank you, Maggie, the whole team, for putting this together. And that it is regularly reviewed and updated, this is all so important. I think my question is, I know getting support on doing communication externally can be challenging. We don't have a lot of funding for that, but are there ways that either the board can help or anyone can assist you in getting more clarity? I mean, I think as board members, we all field calls all the time around what is the work of the Water Board and why are you doing this because it's impacting that and those sorts of questions. And so I'd love to see us be able to get this more in front of the public, aside from the website. Can you talk about any efforts underway?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I'm going to Hunter's Point for a meeting, as I mentioned, tomorrow. I've been engaging with them over the last year and a half. And the first meeting, we didn't have the strategic work plan done. But I went there and they're like, what does EPA do? And what is San Francisco Department of Public Health and DTSC? And they were just like, help me, Eileen. And so the next time I came back, we had a strategic work plan and I bought copies of this, but I said, you don't necessarily want to go through it. We have the 2-page overview that Board Member Batty asked for, and they loved it. And then I was able to explain to them, but they could take away with them, here's the 2-page overview for those who want it. And I said, it's on our website, but I bought physical hard copies for them that, you know, this is what we do. And then it was easy to them to explain, well, this is what DTSC's role is. This is what the Department of Public Health, this is EPA's role. So we've used it a lot in our community outreach. And that's just one example. So it's been very useful. Also, when Maggie and the racial equity team goes out to recruit and they do Zoom sessions and they go out to campuses, once again, the strategic work plan, they have found very helpful. In fact, I think after one of them sessions that they hadn't presented it, someone said, do you have a strategic work plan? And because a lot of good organizations do, and it was great that they could send the person the link, and then it got incorporated into our informational sessions. So it's been a great tool for reaching out in the community, also reaching, you know, for recruiting. And then last week, I was asked to speak at the Bay Area Clean Water Agency's yearly meeting, and they wanted me to talk about the regulator priorities. And I said, well, of course, our priority is working with BAQA to, you know, support our mission of protecting San Francisco Bay, public health and water quality. But since you gave me 15 minutes to talk, I can't talk about that and nutrients. We had a whole panel talking about nutrients. So I went ahead and presented our strategic work plan so they understand there's other work we do at the Water Board, even though we jump to the BAQA agencies all the time to meet, like I did yesterday with one of them, that we do a whole scope of work. So it's also useful for letting others know the whole scope, as Maggie put up that slide that shows all the different programs we have. Sometimes I think the people that work with Keith and his team think, oh, this is all we do at the Water Board, or they work with Haiti and they work with Kimberly and think we have this indefinite number of resources. We have finite and number of resources, and I am so impressed with the work that our team achieves with the limited resources we have.
Thank you. I'll just make, maybe this is a stretch goal, but going forward, I was looking at the pages around collaboration, who we collaborate with, which is focused on the state and federal agencies. But I hope in future years that will continue to grow to include a wide variety of nonprofits. I'm always telling nonprofits that reach out to me, come to the board meetings, come speak, submit a comment, whatever. But and even private industry as well. The issues that we face around the bay and around the oceanside protection and sea level rise is going to take everybody. And so I'd love to see us think about expanding that collaborative circle over time.
And comment well noted. And we actually, that's a snapshot. I mean, we do collaborate with a lot of nonprofits. Chevron and people, we have NPDES permits. They've, you know, reached out to me as soon as I started with the Water Board. So that's kind of a snapshot, but it is an area that we can continue to grow. I agree.
Board Member Ransom.
I think my question really got answered, but I was just more curious if this is helping with recruiting staff.
Yes, I think it is, because it's clearer to staff what we do in the programs. Because although you get hired maybe as a young, you know, an engineer or environmental scientist, and maybe the opening happens to be, let's say, in site cleanup, but someone can understand, oh, at some point I could go ahead and apply for an opening in the watershed. So I think it's what I'm really proud of it is it really talks about all the programs we do. And I didn't feel like we had maybe as one comprehensive document a couple years ago that talked about all the programs. So it's a way to showcase our work. I think the photos show how happy the people are. I think that's the other thing. People come here because of our mission and because of the people. It's definitely been very useful for that.
Perfect. And nice presentation.
Thanks. Let me just check in with Board Member Kissinger.
Thanks. I don't have anything to add. I mean, I want to echo what Jane said. I think this is a wonderful document. It's incredibly useful. You know, it's a good reminder to me every time I look at it to be reminded of the scope of a program. So I appreciate the effort, that obviously, and the thought that went into putting it together.
Thank you. Thank you to the team. When we find ourselves in July with a new state budget, if you could include in a future informational item a little bit about the different account codes that, or the accounts that fund these main elements of the program, I think it would be helpful for us to re-educate ourselves about the sources of funding and any changes in PYs and staffing. I'm just mindful of the budget challenges that lie ahead in the next couple of months. And if we have changes, it would be helpful when the dust settles. It may not be in early July that we know this, but when you and Tom and Ross know this, it would be very helpful to be briefed on that, even as an informational item. And thank you. Thank you to the team, Maggie, Eileen, Demir and others for putting this together. And I'm encouraging us to continue to use it, as Jane said, for external communication as well. Thank you. Would you like to move on to item 8, the site cleanup program?
Sure, it's great. Now that we've talked big with the strategic work plan, we can go into our informational item, which is an update on the toxics cleanup division, and in particular, the site cleanup program, which is in the toxics division, and it oversees the investigation and cleanup of soil, sediment, soil vapor, and groundwater contamination from spill and leak sources, other than the underground storage tanks and military lands, which is part of the Department of Defense program. Katie's looking forward to updating you on the site cleanup program, and its work does not typically come before the board because that authority has been delegated down. So unlike MPDS permits that you see generally almost every board meeting, I don't want you thinking the site cleanup program, they're doing lots of work, lots of letters, lots of directives are going out every day. And since this really hasn't been before the board, really since 2019, we thought it was an opportune time to provide an update on key activities and summarize accomplishments. So Katie Kula, who's the senior water resource control engineer and the section leader of the site cleanup program, will give the presentation. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you, Eileen. Good morning, board members. As Eileen said, my name is Katie Kula, and I'm a senior water resource control engineer in the toxics cleanup division. I manage a section of 5 engineers and geologists, as well as 1 scientific aide. And for the last year and a half, I've managed the site cleanup program. Today, I'll provide an update on the work we do in the site cleanup program. I'll talk a little more about our current priorities. And finally, I'll mention a few of the challenges that we face. I'm going to use a few words today that I want to define now for clarity. I'll use the terms cases and sites interchangeably. Those refer to the specific locations of contamination releases and the extent of the contamination. If I say dischargers or responsible parties, I mean the person or entity that caused the contamination or that's taking responsibility for cleaning it up. I may also use the words cleanup and remediate interchangeably, and those both mean the act of removing or reducing contamination in the environment. So the staff in the site cleanup program are engineers, geologists, and environmental scientists from both the toxics cleanup division and the groundwater protection divisions, with a few staff supporting us in the enforcement section. We have about 21 positions funded by direct cost recovery that's billed to the dischargers, and about 3 positions funded from the site cleanup subaccount program, which was created in 2015. This small amount of additional funding allows our staff to work on projects that they can't bill directly to the cleanup projects. Staff who work on cleanup program sites also work on underground storage tank cases, Department of Defense cases, enforcement actions, and spill response. They also collaborate with other programs in our region on issues such as stormwater management, watershed and wetland restoration, landfills, and landfills. Our team has a wide range of experience and educational backgrounds, and we encourage our staff to work together to share their expertise. The photo on this slide shows an example of one of our cleanup sites. This is an excavation of petroleum-stained clay soils in an area with a very shallow groundwater table. So our program oversees the investigation and cleanup of contamination from spill and leak sources other than underground storage tanks and military lands, which are managed in their own programs. This includes a wide variety of historic operations, including things like dry cleaners, metal recyclers, semiconductor manufacturing, and other commercial and industrial facilities. The types of contamination that we oversee include metals, petroleum products, volatile organic compounds, polychlorinated biphenols, or PCBs, and as my colleague Kimberly will tell you about in a little bit, PFAS. The wide range of types of sites and types of contamination means that no two cases are the same, and it keeps our jobs interesting and occasionally challenging. The photo on this slide shows a typical groundwater monitoring setup. A pump is powered by a car battery to pull groundwater from a monitoring well, which is installed in a commercial business parking lot in this case. Excess pumped groundwater is containerized, sampled, and disposed of properly. So how do we identify new cases for the cleanup program? property owners apply for our oversight because they have identified contamination on their property. It's typically identified due to a property transfer or redevelopment project, bank loan restructuring, or because of an observed spill or leak. We have a case intake team who reviews these applications and determines if they need our oversight. We work with the Department of Toxic Substances Control to decide which agency will oversee the case. And sometimes we work with specific local agencies. Our current case intake team is made up of three staff, Helen Hill, Sarus Ligat, and Karina Cornejo. These are two screenshots from our database called GeoTracker, which is available to the public to view, that we use to manage data and reports related to cleanup cases. The figure on the left shows the entire region, almost, and highlights how the majority of our cases are located in urban areas. The figure on the right is a zoomed in view of Oakland, and the squares with X's represent closed cases, and the solid green squares are open cases. We currently manage about 630 open active cases, which means that the average number of cases that a typical case manager is responsible for is somewhere around 20 or 30. The photo on this slide, this graph shows the, cleanup cases that we oversee go through a multi-step process. First, the discharger investigates the nature and extent of contamination. This could include soil, groundwater, soil vapor, and indoor air sampling. We review and approve their work plans and their investigation completion reports. Then the discharger would propose site-specific remediation. We would review and approve the design and implementation or completion reports. Often remediation is followed by several years of monitoring to determine if the remediation was successful. Sometimes this process may repeat itself more than once. For example, additional investigation may be needed after cleanup, or more than one type of cleanup may need to be implemented. Each of these phases can take several years to complete. When we're satisfied that contamination no longer poses a threat to water quality in the environment or to human health, we close the case. We use a multiple lines of evidence, low threat evaluation to close cases because it's not usually feasible to remove all contamination. Sometimes we need to use the regulatory authority granted to us under Water Code Section 13267 or 13304 to require dischargers to investigate and clean up their sites. However, many of the cleanups that we oversee progress in a cooperative manner. All right, now the graph. This graph shows the status of our 630 open cases. Moving clockwise around the graph, I'll mention a little about each status. About a quarter of cases are in the site assessment phase, meaning that investigation is ongoing. About 43% of our cases are in remediation, which means that some type of cleanup is actively occurring. Currently, a typical case spends an average of 9 years in remediation. The long-term monitoring status indicates that we are monitoring to ensure the success of remediation or mitigation, and about 25% of our cases are in this status. The current average is about 6 years in this long-term monitoring status. But that may actually increase now that we are focusing more on vapor intrusion and monitoring the long-term performance of mitigation systems. And finally, about 5% of our cases are eligible for closure, which means that we are working on final steps like destroying monitoring wells, finalizing risk management plans, or writing and recording deed restrictions. So Eileen and Maggie gave you a great update about our region's strategic work plan earlier. The site cleanup program has 6 priorities for the next 2 fiscal years, which I've summarized here. I'm going to provide a little bit more detail about 2 of these priorities outlined in the box. And Kimberly West will talk more about PFAS in a few minutes. Related to the last priority to update the environmental screening levels, I just want to highlight how lucky we are in our region to have Ross Steenson and Dr. Nicole Fry, who along with others have developed and maintained these environmental screening levels that are utilized by many dischargers, consultants, and other regulatory agencies across the whole state. We continue to consider the impacts of climate change and utilize the latest science regarding sea level and groundwater rise on the cleanup sites that we manage. Those potential impacts can include the emergence of contaminated groundwater, surface flooding and erosion, increased mobilization of contamination, and an increase in potential for vapor intrusion. Our internal team has developed a mapping tool for case managers to evaluate which of their sites are vulnerable to sea level and groundwater rise over the next 50 to 100 years. An example from the 100-year scenario is shown in the picture on the slide. The pink areas may be subject to groundwater rise, and the blue areas may be subject to sea level rise. Case managers can use this mapping tool to evaluate their cases and ensure that remedial alternatives are designed with future impacts in mind, and to evaluate the need for long-term monitoring or other protective measures prior to closing a case. Next slide, it's not working anymore. Thank you. The figure on this slide shows many of the areas highlighted in orange and red in our region that have faced and continue to face environmental injustices. The outlines are generated using a tool called CalEnviroScreen 4.0, which was developed by the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. CalEnviroScreen is a screening method to identify communities that are disproportionately burdened by multiple sources of pollution, such as air pollution or groundwater and soil contamination. Statewide, there are a disproportionate number of cleanup cases located in these communities. And these cases often lack the funding and community engagement to move them forward quickly. Our case managers prioritize these cases, encourage the dischargers to seek additional funding through grants, and conduct community outreach to ensure that residents understand any potential risks and the work that's being done. As Eileen mentioned in today's executive officer report, there's a summary of our recent outreach with All Positives Possible, which is a Vallejo community group that we've been working with over the last year. And there are 98 cases in environmental justice communities in our region. The picture on this slide shows the installation of a subslab depressurization system being installed in an existing warehouse building. Concrete was then poured over the pipes and gravel, and contaminated vapors can be pumped out from beneath the building. In addition to the strategic work plan priorities, we also track 4 program metrics, which I think Dr. Gunther was asking about a little bit ago. So far this fiscal year, we've closed 24 cases, which exceeds our goal of 15. We've seen slower progress in recent years moving cases into remediation. This may be due to several factors. For example, the open cases that have not yet begun remediation, which is about a quarter of our open cases, have an average age of 13 years, which indicates that they may have limited funds and are progressing slowly, or there may not be a need to conduct active remediation. Of the cases that have been sufficiently investigated, 91% have human health exposure controlled, which means that humans do not have direct exposure to the contamination. The other 9% are mainly vapor intrusion exposures, and those are some of our highest priority sites. Again, of the cases that have been sufficiently investigated, 88% have groundwater migration controlled, which means that contamination in groundwater is no longer migrating away from the site. This graph shows the total active cases, the blue line across the top, as well as the number of cases closed in gray and open in orange over the last 7 fiscal years. You can see that the total number of cases we oversee remains pretty constant because we open about as many new cases as we close each year. For reference, the average age of the cases we closed this fiscal year was 17 years. It takes a long time to fully investigate and remediate the sites that we oversee. This graph also shows the decrease in the number of new cases over the last few years, which may be partly due to the slowdown in new redevelopment projects due to higher interest rates and other economic factors. The photo on this slide shows a groundwater pump and treat system being installed. Pipes would eventually be installed to route groundwater to the green tank for storage and to the blue vessels, which are full of granular carbon to filter out contaminants. Typically, the investigation and cleanup projects that we oversee are paid for by the discharger or property owner and can cost anywhere from a few hundred thousand to several million dollars over the entire project. Some responsible parties, like the owners of a small dry cleaner, may not be able to afford all of the investigation and cleanup work. Underground storage tank cleanup projects can be reimbursed for their work from the state's cleanup fund, but that option was not historically available to other types of cleanups. The site cleanup subaccount, or SCAP grant program, sets aside a small portion of funds from the underground storage tank cleanup fund to help pay for other types of cleanups. SCAP grant funds are limited to $34 million for the entire state per fiscal year, and the applicant pool is very large. There are around 470 applicants currently across the state. This is a small fraction of the budget for the underground storage tank program. Applicants are prioritized based on several factors, including the threat to human health or the environment, disadvantage or small community impact, and the overall environmental benefit of the project. The final challenge I want to highlight today is vapor intrusion. The figure on this slide shows a cartoon diagram of how vapor intrusion might occur. Certain types of contamination in groundwater and soil can release vapors, which migrate through the pores in soil and cracks and gaps in building slabs into indoor air. Of our active cleanup cases, more than half have soil vapor contamination and a potential for vapor intrusion from chemicals like tetrachloroethene, which was commonly used at dry cleaners for decades. We track cases where chemicals have been detected in indoor air above relevant health screening levels and have identified at least 90 cleanup cases where vapor intrusion was occurring in the last few years. Two members of our staff participate in the statewide vapor intrusion work group, which is a joint effort between the water boards and the Department of Toxic Substances Control. Last year, the work group released a guidance document to help dischargers, consultants, and our case managers consistently screen and evaluate buildings for vapor intrusion. In June of 2022, our region released a technical resource about selecting appropriate vapor intrusion mitigation measures and monitoring their performance. When we are notified that vapor intrusion is or may be occurring, case managers have to prioritize that case to ensure that prompt response actions are taken. These can include notifying tenants and other members of the public and quickly requiring the implementation of mitigation or remediation and then monitoring its effectiveness. You may have noticed that I mentioned the word prioritize many times today because we have many competing priorities that our staff work hard to balance every day. I'm really proud of the work that staff in the site cleanup program do and the collaborative and data-driven nature of our oversight. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Katie. Questions from board members? Bill, anything?
Yeah, I've got one question. Thanks very much for a really nice presentation. I'm interested to hear about how it's decided whether a case is going to be handled by DTSC or by the board, and put that in context with the total number of cases that we're handling within our region that DTSC is covering. What's their comparative number? I guess sort of what I'm asking is, do we handle the majority of the cases around the bay, or is it sort of equally divided? And again, back to my original question, how is it decided who does what?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'll take a shot at that. I'm Alec Noggle, the Toxics Cleanup Division Manager. I don't know the exact number of cases that the DTSC has. They track everything in their database called EnviroStore. But I do know that under this memorandum of agreement that we have with them, we coordinate with them each month, our case intake team, to make sure that, you know, we have equal shot at taking these new cases that come in. And it is a relatively 50-50 split on new cases that are coming in the door between the two agencies. But I don't know the total number in their portfolio.
Is there some sense that one is faster than another, or some? I mean, it's been a long time since I've handled a cleanup case. There used to be sort of a preference to go to the water board because there was a sense of more focus. But you know, there were lots of strategic considerations from a from a potentially responsible party about where they tried to push. Is there some sense that you have about kind of what the strategic considerations are from the other side of the table?
Well, in general, historically, the Water Board focused on taking cases that had more of a groundwater contaminant impact, and the Department of Toxic Substances Control would take cases that had a more human health focus. But then when vapor intrusion came along, it was kind of evenly split, evenly. There's just so many vapor intrusion cases, as Katie pointed out. The other thing in terms of preferences, I think, you know, to our credit, I think we're seen as moving things a little more quickly, perhaps. We have a lighter touch program, a more nimble program, I like to say. The Department of Toxic Substances Control uses a federal, what's called the National Contingency Plan process that has to, you know, is fairly, well, you may have recalled a couple months ago hearing a presentation on our military program from Selena Hernandez. And it's a 9-step process, and you have to tick all the boxes. We can be a little more nimble and reasonable and pragmatic when we go through this process because we have this concept of low threat closure. The Department of Toxic Substances Control currently doesn't use that.
Ross, do you want to add anything?
I was just going to expand a little bit. The memorandum of agreement from 2005 between DTSC and the water boards has some specific considerations which cases might go to the regional board versus DTSC. Alec just addressed some of those. In addition, our team has a former member of our team. We coordinated pretty closely with DTSC, and if we have too many applications at any one time that are coming to us, we have negotiated DTSC taking some of those. There's also a bit of recognition about us being more nimble than DTSC. So sometimes they've asked us to take something because it's a redevelopment site and it needs to move more quickly. There's other examples where it was clear there was going to be a very heavy public engagement process, and they have embedded staff in their program on their side of the house, and so we've had them take cases in that situation. So I think it's an ongoing dialogue, and we're trying to be reasonable about who takes what.
Eileen, do you want to add anything?
No, I think Ross covered it. That's great. Thank you,
Bill. You may have a follow up question.
No, I was just saying thank you. That's very helpful.
Okay. Dr. Gunther.
Thanks for this presentation. I'm always astonished by the scale of this problem. And I think it's great that you have come up with statistics that clarify that. And I think it's important that the board provide this frame context whenever we talk about this publicly, without it making sound like we're whining about being understaffed. But the problem is enormous. I was struck when you said that we're sort of opening about as many cases as we're closing. When we open these cases, most of them are based on something that happened at that site, usually a long time ago.
Yes, that's true.
Okay. So we have changed our behavior as a society and an economy so that we're not dumping as much stuff on the ground and whatever. There's this historic context to what we're doing. Caught in your presentation. I mean, we're playing catch up from whatever the 1930s or whatever. And I think that we spent generations causing this problem, and now we're spending generations trying to fix it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important context to lay out so that it's not like we're just chasing our tails here, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then at some point my understanding is we're still trying to get our heads around exactly what groundwater rise is going to mean for specifically for this program.
Mm-hmm.
We know it's a physical reality we're going to have to deal with. Can we at some point have a little more information about kind of how we're beginning to get our heads around this?
Yes, we can plan. And that's something actually Ross and I have talked with some of the Hunters Point Great. Community about, because they're concerned about that. So we can bring that back as a future informational item.
Great.
Thank you. And thanks for your comment too about this is a historical problem. Katie and her team are doing great work, but there's such a backlog from, as you said, decades ago.
Well, maybe one day I'll tell you my story about talking about underground tanks in LA in 1982 and how the press responded. It was pretty fun. So it's been a long time.
Other board member comment? Board member Batty.
You can promote me to doctor. That's
yeah.
good.
I have a question that I don't need to answer it now, but as I was listening to your excellent presentation, thank you, it did make me think about that we have not heard from Marinwood in a long time on their cleanup. And I wondered if there was any update, and maybe we know now or we can talk about it later, but I was just curious. We haven't heard from them in quite a while.
We can provide an update if you want the next EO report, but they've been meeting, their deadlines to date. So I guess because they've been meeting it, we haven't had people come to complain. And our team, I want to give credit to Alec and the team who've been doing a great job, Cleet, Brian Thompson, working with the team that needs to clean it up, and then also with the developer who's interested in developing the land. So I think we're making good progress. Thank you.
Alec, do you want to add anything?
I agree exactly with what Eileen is saying, that they seem to be happy at the moment because things are progressing and the response times have been great. And,
music to my ears.
Potential redeveloper, and that seems to be all.
Bill, what did you say?
I said music to my ears.
Oh, yes.
Thank you. And thank you for asking the question, Jane.
Anything further on this? Katie, thank you for your presentation. I really appreciated the metrics around active cases, closed cases, how long a case stays until it, gets put to bed, and all the other things. So I think that really helps our collective understanding as a board as we support the work that you do. So thank you so much for this presentation. And let's move to the not unrelated PFAS presentation.
Great. And maybe just to build on what Dr. Gunther said is that PFAS, this problem did not occur yesterday. We are dealing with a problem that started decades ago. And Kimberly West, our water resource control engineer who leads our PFAS team, is going to provide background information on PFAS, discuss the status of PFAS investigations and remediation in the site cleanup program. We have not previously given an update to the board on this topic, but it's kind of timely. I was working with Alec and Kimberly a while back to try to plan this, probably about 9 months ago. And we kind of coordinate our board presentations, info items, planned it for this meeting, which turned out kind of opportune because for those of you who aren't aware, EPA listed MCL for drinking water for PFAS. So I want to turn it over to Kimberly, and I do think we have someone for public comment on this to point out later in the room. But with that, Kimberly, why don't you take it away?
Great. Thank you. Hi, my name is Kimberly West, and I am a water resource control engineer in the Toxics Cleanup Division. And I'm here to talk with you today about one of our strategic work plan priorities for the site cleanup program, and that is PFAS investigations in the site cleanup program. All right, so PFAS, they are per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. PFAS are a group of over 14,000 synthetic compounds, and they have similar chemical structures and unique physical properties. Namely, PFAS repel oil and water, they reduce friction, and they withstand really high temperatures. So these properties make PFAS a really useful compound, right? And we put it in all kinds of products. These same properties make PFAS really difficult to get rid of once it's in the environment. So on the right side of this slide, you can see the chemical structures for PFOA, which is perfluorooctanoic acid, and PFOS, which is perfluorooctane sulfonic acid. I'm calling out these two PFAS compounds in particular because they are probably the most pervasive in our environment, and they're definitely the most well-studied. I'm going to refer to them throughout the talk today. And also, I want to note that when I talk about the entire class of compounds, PFAS, I tend to say PFAS. And when I'm talking about the one particular compound, PFOS, I tend to say PFOS to distinguish the two. So why do we care about PFAS? Well, PFAS are structurally stable, so they do not degrade in the environment. Since the 1940s, they've been widely used in all kinds of commercial products and chemical processes. So you can find PFAS in anything from ski wax to contact lenses. And PFAS are really mobile in water, so they travel through the environment. When you add their use and their mobility in the environment, you can see that they're widely distributed throughout the entire planet. And it's important to note the toxicity studies have shown that some PFAS have very serious effects to human health and ecological health. Before we can talk about site cleanup with PFAS, we have to understand the fate and transport of PFAS in the environment. So this picture here is a visual representation showing a potential PFAS industrial facility on the left side. And then it shows a whole bunch of different pathways by which PFAS can enter our soil, our stormwater runoff, our groundwater. It gets into the air. It can get into lakes and streams and our oceans, and it can even get into our bodies. So we're currently investigating to determine how much PFAS is detected in these different places in our environment. Many of the PFAS investigations that we're currently managing in our region were initiated by state water board orders based on the likelihood of a facility to use, store, or release PFAS. Beginning in 2019, the state water board issued PFAS investigation orders statewide to determine the presence or absence of PFAS at various facilities. The map on this slide outlines our region in red, and to date, the state water board has issued orders in our region to 4 airports, 29 landfills, 8 chrome platers, and 35 refineries and bulk fuel terminals. The orders require property owners to sample groundwater and soil and stormwater for a suite of 30 to 40 different PFAS compounds. The orders were issued by the state water board, and we at the regional board are responsible for managing those investigations. So after initial PFAS data is collected, the state water board order has been satisfied. And it's then up to us at the regional board to determine if further investigation is needed. The airports and the landfill orders in our region have been completed. And the chrome platers and bulk fuel terminals and refineries are still collecting initial data. As a reminder, there are also Department of Defense military sites at which we're managing PFAS. And those are not shown on this map, but the Department of Defense PFAS cases were discussed in, as we mentioned earlier, in February in a board meeting by Selena Hernandez. So, in addition to the sites that were identified by the state water board orders, we, the regional board, have identified 25 to 30 potential source sites that we're initiating the PFAS investigations for. So these facilities, as shown on this picture, include things like refineries and bulk fuel terminals that did not get the state board order, aircraft and aerospace manufacturing and maintenance facilities, fire response sites or fire training areas, chrome platers that did not get the PFAS state board orders, fire truck fleet maintenance facilities, and other different kinds of industrial facilities. So we've collected initial PFAS data at these sites, and the investigations are ongoing. Next slide, please. Thanks. All right, so let's look at some of that initial data. This graph shows the maximum concentrations of PFOS and PFOA detected in groundwater at specific facilities within our region, categorized by facility type. So each set of green and purple bars represents the maximum PFOS and PFOA detections at a single facility. And the facilities represented on this graph have the highest concentrations for each type of facility listed on the x-axis. The y-axis shows the maximum concentration of PFOS or PFOA in parts per trillion on a logarithmic scale. So there are three things that I want to point out using this data. The first one is that generally, bulk fuel terminals have the highest maximum concentrations of PFAS from the data that we've collected so far, with maximum PFOS concentrations in the hundreds of thousands of parts per trillion. The second thing that I want to draw your attention to is the data labeled roadside fire response. So that is a one-time incident. There was a tanker truck, a fuel tanker truck on a highway that overturned, caught on fire, and the fire department came and they extinguished the fire using aqueous film-forming foam, which has PFAS in it, right? This accident happened in 2006, and this data was collected in 2021. So although most of the sites that we're investigating throughout our region have long-term PFAS releases, this data just shows that even a one-time occurrence can have some long-lasting contamination. The third thing that I do want to mention is that we are detecting very high levels of PFAS in the environment. So for context, the recently finalized federal maximum contaminant levels for drinking water, which Eileen mentioned, they were set for PFOS and PFOA at 4 parts per trillion. And on this graph, we're seeing things in the thousands or sometimes hundreds of thousands of parts per trillion at some of our sites. All right, on the left side of the slide, we have a really pretty picture of an industrial facility, which could be a potential PFAS source site. And on the right side, we have pictures of potential receptors. The receptors that we're concerned about for PFAS are primarily groundwater supply wells and aquatic habitats. So there's more than one way to structure an environmental investigation. For instance, one strategy could identify potential sources of contamination and look for receptors that might be impacted, as shown by the arrow at the top of the screen. And this is how we actually conduct most of our investigations in the site cleanup program. Or a second strategy could first identify impacted receptors and then look for nearby potential sources of that contamination. For PFAS, we're trying to be really holistic and we're looking at it from both directions. Strategy one starts with source sites. So this figure shows our region in orange. And the little dots on the map show the different locations of potential PFAS source sites where we've already collected PFAS data. Our region is managing about 75 sites that received the State Water Board PFAS orders and an additional 25 to 30 sites that were identified through our own investigations. So the source-focused investigation strategy has four main steps. So first, we identify the potential PFAS source sites. Second, we collect initial PFAS data. Third, we prioritize those sites, looking for sites that have high PFAS concentrations or that are near potential receptors. And number four, we focus on source cleanup and cleaning up plumes that have the potential to reach receptors. Sounds pretty straightforward, right? This is what we do for most of our sites. Well, PFAS are pretty complicated. They have unique chemical properties that just make things a little more difficult. So PFAS may be toxic at lower levels than other contaminants. They migrate farther in the environment than most chemicals. And they transform into other PFAS compounds, and they never fully degrade. So the fate and transport analyses are really complex. A lot of PFAS-specific technical questions come up during investigations. To answer some of those questions, we have put together a cross-divisional group of case managers and supervisors to support case managers. So the members of the PFAS team are shown on this slide. And the PFAS team supports case managers by peer reviewing PFAS work plans and reports, by joining meetings with PFAS dischargers, and by working with management to share new technical information and provide consistent recommendations on PFAS cases. All right, let's go back and talk about strategy two. So strategy two starts at receptors. Namely, the receptor we're most worried about are drinking water supply wells. So step one is to identify PFAS-impacted public drinking water supply wells. And then step two is to step out from there and look for sources that could be causing that contamination. In coordination with the Division of Drinking Water and local drinking water agencies, we've identified public drinking water supply wells in our region that have been impacted by PFAS. And again, if you look at that picture on the right, our region's outlined in orange, and all of those little gray water droplets on there are the locations of public drinking water supply wells that have some kind of detection of PFAS. Specifically, there are over 2,000 public drinking water wells in our region, and about 250 of those public drinking water supply wells have been tested for PFAS. About 150 of those wells have found some kind of PFAS detection. And of those 150 wells, about 65 wells have at least one PFAS compound that exceeds the newly released federal maximum contaminant levels. Most of the PFAS impacted wells are in the highly urbanized Livermore and Santa Clara valleys. It is really important to note here that the water agencies take measures to ensure that the water served to their customers does not exceed the PFAS standards, right? So they take extreme measures to either take impacted wells offline or treat and blend the water from impacted water supply wells to meet all of the water quality standards. In addition to the about 250 supply wells for which we already have PFAS data, the State Water Board's Division of Drinking Water is conducting PFAS testing of supply wells in disadvantaged communities, or DACs. Across the state, the Division of Drinking Water is sampling almost 4,000 wells in this effort. Seven of those wells are located in our region, and the locations of these seven wells are shown with the blue water drops on the map on this slide. Disadvantaged communities are defined by their median annual household incomes, and it's really important to note that the testing is being conducted by the Division of Drinking Water at no cost to these water systems. To track impacted supply wells and identify nearby source sites in our area, we have established a cross-divisional team working together to protect water quality in the supply wells. So this slide shows the members of our supply well protection team. One of the most important functions of this team is to engage with local water agencies to share information on water quality and water treatment, to hear their concerns, and to collaborate on solutions. I'm going too far now. All right. So, I can't quite get it right. Okay. I'm going to try one more time. Okay. We're good. So PFAS has been in the news a lot lately. So I'm going to point out a couple of recent federal regulations that are likely to have big impacts on our site cleanup program. So the first is that April 10th, the US EPA issued maximum contaminant levels for drinking water for six different PFAS compounds. MCLs are the maximum concentration of the contaminant allowed to be in drinking water in a public water system. The MCLs are shown on the table on the right, and I think it's really interesting to note that for PFOS and PFOA, the MCLs were set at the lowest reliable detection limit. So the EPA determined that number to be 4 parts per trillion. This is a really low number. These chemicals are really toxic. These PFAS MCLs have a big effect on the site cleanup program. Because our basin plan specifies that all groundwater in the Bay Area has the potential beneficial use as drinking water, the site cleanup program often considers MCLs when setting cleanup goals for site remediation. All right, and the second federal regulation we're going to talk about is the designation as CERCLA hazardous substances. So on April 19th, the US EPA designated, again, PFOS and PFOA as CERCLA hazardous substances. CERCLA is more commonly known as the Federal Superfund Program. And this hazardous substance designation is going to have huge impacts on our site cleanup program. I'm going to name three of them really quickly. So first, it sets reportable quantities. So anytime a facility releases 1 pound or more of PFOS or PFOA within a 24-hour period, it has to be reported to the authorities. Number two, it establishes cost recovery mechanisms. So the government or private parties are now allowed to recover cleanup costs from potentially responsible parties. And number three, PFOS and PFOA sampling are now considered in environmental site assessment investigations. Environmental site assessment investigations are often conducted before a property transfer or a redevelopment. So we're expecting that as more people start looking for PFAS, more people are going to start finding PFAS, and that's likely to lead to an increase in the number of new cases coming into the site cleanup program. Next slide. Okay, so I'm going to wrap up with two more slides. The first shows where we are now. Well, we are managing about 100 PFAS cases in our region. Most of those cases are in the investigation phase, and we are moving toward remediation. Most full-scale PFAS remediation systems that are available right now are groundwater extraction and treatment systems. And these pump and treat systems, it's able to remove PFAS from the water, but then it typically generates a concentrated PFAS waste that needs to be managed. So the last slide is trying to show where we're going or where we think we're going. Well, we have learned enough about PFAS to know that there's a lot that we still need to learn, right? We have a clear strategy for investigation and prioritization of PFAS cases in our region. And the EPA has now set regulations that are going to have a trickle-down effect. If I could look into my crystal ball, I would say that all of these things are going to lead us to more PFAS cases in the site cleanup program and to more active PFAS remediation. Hopefully that remediation is going to include different technologies that are able to fully destroy PFAS. And a lot of those technologies are currently in development, which is really great news for us because it's clear now more than ever that there's a lot of work to do on this. Oops. Let's go back one. Anyway, so the last slide just says thank you. Perfect. Thanks. And I'm happy. First of all, sincerely, thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk about PFAS, something that we're all thinking about a lot and important to have the discussions. So I'd like to open it up for discussion.
Thank you, Kimberly. Let me go around the board. Bill, would you like to comment?
Sure. I have a few questions. I have to say, you know, I kind of started my career as a Superfund lawyer, and I'm every time I hear a presentation of PFAS, I'm just sort of shocked that we are where we are today when the Superfund program has been around a long time, and obviously the state, you know, has had its own program that predated Superfund. And I always ask myself, how did we get here? How is it that so many years down the road, we're only now beginning to sort of identify this when these chemicals have been used, as you pointed out, beginning in the 40s. Let me ask my first question that, you know, is kind of shocking to me, which is the numbers of that you came up with the well survey, where you indicated about 2,000 wells have been surveyed. Of that, 250 had the tax, of which 150 of them, I'm not going to have it exactly right, I'm sorry, 250 of the 2,000 had the tax, 250 were significant, and 65 were above MCL. So a quarter of the ones which had detects, I guess that's what it was, 150 had detects, 65 of them were above MCL. So a quarter of the ones that had detects were above MCL level assessment set. I guess my first question is, was that 2000 original survey? Oh, I see. Okay, I'm sorry. So the 2000 represents all the groundwater wells. 250 were the ones that were tested for PFAS. So the first question is, were those ones that, were they random, or were they kind of identified as ones they were really concerned about in areas like Livermore, where there were concerns predated PFAS being an issue?
Yeah, so a lot of the wells that have been tested in response to Division of Drinking Water orders that have gone out. And those started by targeting areas that were near areas with known PFAS impacts. So it started with the State Water Board investigation orders. And then when we found PFAS at some sites, the State Water Board jumped out from there and looked for nearby supply wells and sent orders around there. So we are kind of targeting some of the areas that we think that we have high detections for the wells that have been tested so far. But there's a nationwide effort to actually expand PFAS testing right now through the uncontaminated UCMR.
Unregulated, thank you.
So UCMR 5 is requiring PFAS testing of 29 different PFAS at wells throughout the entire country right now. So we are getting a lot more data rolling in these days.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the 150 wells that had PFAS detections, mm-hmm. a quarter of them exceeded the MCLs is kind of astounding. I take it those wells were closed, or were those wells subject to pump and treat, or were all the 150 wells with PFAS detection subject to pump and treat or otherwise closed?
Yeah, well, I do want to point out that the MCLs for PFOS and PFOA were set at the lowest reliable detection limit. So there are detections out there at 0.1 part per trillion of PFOS, and that is officially below the federal MCL. But the MCL was kind of set at the point where if it's detected, let's call that something that raises the alarms. So that's why a significant portion of anything that's detected automatically exceeds the MCLs. Does that help answer the question?
Yeah, I mean, so what happens with all those wells that have been identified with levels in excess of the MCL? Are they shut or subject to pump and treat, or we're still trying to figure out what to do with them?
No, that's a great question. So the federal MCLs still need to be adopted by the State Water Board. So those federal MCLs came out in April, and we expect it to be about 18 months before they're officially adopted by the State Water Board. In the meantime, we do have other PFAS screening standards, notification levels, and response levels that were set years ago by other California departments, right? So anything that is above, any detections of PFAS that are above the response levels automatically need to be taken out of service, or that water needs to be treated before it can be served. And anything above a notification level, anyone who gets that water needs to be notified that there is PFAS at a certain level in their water.
Yeah, that's kind of a happy bit of news that people will be getting, I guess. What happened? You mentioned it's unclear what to do with the concentrated leachate that you're going to take out of the treated water. What happens to it? You can't burn it. Does it get sent? What just put in a drum and store it someplace? What happens to it?
Yeah, well, you actually can burn it. You just have to burn it at really high temperatures for it to completely mineralize, right? So most of the technologies that remove the PFAS from the groundwater are an ion exchange resin or a granular activated carbon. And I believe that both of those media can be regenerated. So you can take them to a facility, then you can treat them at really high temperatures, burn off that PFAS, mineralize the PFAS, and then potentially reuse that media again.
Are there such facilities in California now?
You know what? I don't think that that's approved in California at this time. I'm a little fuzzy on that, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it suggests there's going to be a huge burst of Superfund litigation mm-hmm. coming down the pike. Pretty stunning. I guess the last question, but I don't expect you to have an answer, is how did we get here? I mean, if it's so toxic, how is it that, you know, only now is the regulatory scrutiny increasing? How is it that it hasn't happened earlier?
Have you seen the movie Dark Waters? it's a great movie. It stars Mark Ruffalo, and it does talk a lot about this. I think that the manufacturers have known about some of the health issues revolving around PFAS since maybe the 60s. And it wasn't until the 2000s that the research really started to open up and it started to become known worldwide. And then it's just been in the past, I don't know, 5, maybe 10 years, if you look at Europe, that things have started to be regulated.
Yeah, I love the fact that it's in among other places, contact lenses. So
I know, right?
Anyway. Talking. Anyway, thanks very much. It was a very good presentation.
Thank you. I'm going to turn to the board in a moment. A quick question for continuing sources of this in our region. To what extent have cities and special districts been able to replace their aqueous firefighting foam?
So there was a Senate bill or assembly bill. I wish that I had this in front of me right now. I think it was 1044 that specified that as of, I want to say it was January 2022, fire departments, it was either January of 2022 or 23, fire departments needed to start replacing their aqueous film-forming foam. There are suitable replacements out there. The one outstanding use is for military specifications. If there is a mil-spec fire department, someone that can respond to military things, they have higher standards, and some of those still include the use of PFAS. But throughout the rest of the state of California, aqueous film-forming foam that includes PFAS is being phased out. There are some exceptions. A notable exception is for bulk fuel terminals and refineries who have an exception until 2028, which may then be extended.
And at some point, Keith will have to remind me how we deal with this in the stormwater permit, but let me turn to the board for questions, comments. Jane.
Thanks, great presentation. And, you know, I'm with Bill, this is extremely troublesome, and I'm thinking about our previous presentation on toxic soils, and oh, we've learned so much. Well, maybe not. It would be, I'm guessing that, of course, the team here and the board members are going to get a lot of questions on this. And as we can get more information that would be helpful to our constituents and to consumers, it'd be really helpful to have that.
I was going to say, we can give you a PFAS fact sheet. Awesome. That's something that we can easily provide to you.
That would be really helpful, and maybe have one on the website for the same. Just for, you know, I have two questions down here besides to check my brand of contact lenses. Can you talk a little bit about the consumer materials that might be common that we use all the time that contain PFAS? I'm particularly interested in the relationship with plastics. And then I don't know that we've really heard what are the human and biological health effects. Yeah, could you say a little bit more?
Absolutely. So there are two things. I do have some of the human health effects written down, and I decided not to go into it because you just can't list them all. But PFAS are interesting compounds because they like to attach to proteins. Most bioaccumulative things to attach, they're lipophilic, they attach to our fats. These ones attach to our proteins. So you find a lot of impacts to your liver, to livers, not your liver, to livers, to kidneys, to muscles. The heart, of course, is a muscle, right? So some of the effects that have been documented for various PFAS, it's still growing, but they include growth and learning issues in children, fertility issues, liver, kidney, and heart issues, increased cholesterol, immune system issues, a decreased response to vaccines and an increased risk of cancer. And that's just to name some of them, right?
Sorry to ask this question, but we do need to talk about this and have clarity.
Oh, no, yeah. No, it's very important. Absolutely. And then let's talk about uses for a second. Karen, can you bring up the bonus slides that I have there? I think the first one actually lists some uses. It's in all kinds of consumer products.
It's probably in the rug here, just so you know.
Right, yes.
Just right off the bat, the rug we're all, yeah. And certain organizations, not the state, certain organizations recently, buildings that have replaced the rugs have spec'd that they have to be PFOF free. And actually San Francisco is one of them.
Yep, absolutely. So it's commonly used, like it's Scotchgard, right? It's in Teflon. It's in anything where, I spilled some water on my jacket and it just runs right off. Oh my gosh, that's so cool, right? Well, it's probably because there's PFAS in my jacket. It's in cosmetics. It's in lotions and shampoos. Not all lotions, not all shampoos, but it's commonly used in those things. It's on guitar strings. It's, you know, to give them the slippery feel. It's on, some of the big ones are textiles, leathers, carpets, upholstery. Do we have that slide that we can bring up? Working on it? Okay, yeah. I put some of the ones that, great, can we presentation mode it? Okay, so just to say, it's in a lot of different things. The synergy with plastics is that it has the ability to make things slip out of molds. So any molded plastic is likely, there's PFAS often used in that process. So microplastics and PFAS often are co-contaminants together, but not necessarily, right? It depends on the process that was used to make the plastic. So this slide shows some common uses and some things that I just thought were like, what, really? It's in there? It's in dental floss, it's in Band-Aids, it's in toilet paper. It's used as a wetting agent for a lot of things. It's in toners and printer ink. It's in lubricants. So you'll find it in hydraulic lifts. You'll find it in, you know, your local service station probably uses PFAS for all kinds of things, not to mention that it's in the upholstery of the cars and it's in a lot of places. So, yeah.
Thank you. I think it really would be helpful to have the fact sheet and that we can share. Thanks.
Sure.
Other board member comments? Go ahead.
Yeah, so this is like 50 years from now, board member is going to be hearing the site cleanup supervisor giving us a report, and they'll ask, so all these PFAS sites are because of what people were doing 50 or 60 years ago with these substances. it's hard to believe. So I understand the focus on prioritizing our sampling around sensitive receptors. Do we have data that tells us that PFAS aren't in some places?
We do. We have some places that have been facilities that have had historical operations that are likely to have used or stored or released PFAS. So we've asked for them to sample their wells for PFAS, and they come back at, well, I'm not going to say no. They don't necessarily come back with zero PFAS, but they come back with levels that we're seeing in other parts of the aquifer. So nothing that shows that that site is a hotspot necessarily.
Okay. And for the, we focused mainly on the drinking water receptors, but you also talked about ecosystem health.
Oh yes.
And ecosystem receptors. So if we look at the sediment samples being collected by the regional monitoring program, if we look at the bioaccumulation sampling, do we find PFAS in those samples as well?
We do. Absolutely. Yes. We've been sampling through the regional monitoring program. We've been sampling for PFAS since 2004, and we've been finding it.
Routinely? I mean, so there's, I guess where I'm getting at is,
yes,
if we're talking about impacts at the level of detection, and we're detecting it everywhere, then this is a much larger problem than just a well here or a well there.
Yes.
Okay.
I would agree. Yes. And in the site cleanup program,
unfortunate.
Yes. In the site cleanup program, we're targeting, we're trying to investigate things that we think could be likely sources of high concentrations,
right?
But when we're looking at the bay in general, we're looking in cormorant eggs, we're looking in harbor seals, we're looking in all kinds of...
Lee Davis is active in this.
Oh, yes, absolutely he
so,
is.
So, yeah. Okay, so then we're... I can see that it's important to target the locations where there might be high concentrations, since those are going to contribute to this gradient across everything. But I think it's important to recognize that we already know they're everywhere.
Agreed. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Other comments? Mark.
Just a quick one. Thanks for the presentation. Excellent work. Just with the sources, I heard a news item yesterday. I think it was San Francisco firefighters, a whole issue about their firefighting suits. They're all lined with PFAS. So they were talking about it from the context of causing cancer to the firefighters, but also the cost of replacing all of these suits, you know, not only citywide, but state and national. So it's a huge cost. The question for sites that have been closed, you know, the investigations happen, closure, official, you know, official letters, all that sort of thing. Is there part of the program to do some random testing or prioritized testing, or is that kind of further down the list at this point?
That's a great question, and I'm going to defer that one to someone else who might have the bigger picture perspective.
Okay.
I'll give that a shot. The answer right now is no. We don't have a plan to do that. Again, we're sort of in this, as Kimberly's getting at. We know the backdrop is it's everywhere. It's a lot of places we look. We're trying to find the worst contributors to supply wells and aquatic habitats. And we're kind of doing this in a triage mode. You know, is this a source and is it contributing, likely to be contributing to one of these receptors, and then asking the question, is it remediable? Can we actually clean it up? And then, you know, negotiating or using our authorities to do that. Right now it's a challenging problem because it's showing up in so many places at low levels and high levels.
And I just add to Alex's response is that, one, thank you, Kimberly. We're lucky to have Kim, who's so passionate about this and who's committed to this and leads the internal program. And you'll hear from one of our public speakers today who's from Zone 7. So you get to hear from somebody who's dealing with it in real time at their groundwater well and how Kim and team have partnered with them. But we've got no new resources for this. So this is just one more thing. You heard from Katie about all the sites she's dealing with. And now we got PFAS, which, as I said, it's in the rug, it's in everything, and it's been around for decades. So We're trying what we can, and I think we need to prioritize. And I think the biggest priority is looking at sources near drinking water, and where, you know, someone like Zone 7 who relies on groundwater, who is looking to drill more wells, looking at what's the potential impact when there's actually PFAS sources in the area. So that's how we're prioritizing our staff time right now, to protect drinking water for, you know, the Bay Area residences.
And I might just add that to get, you know, the question about closed sites, it's not inconceivable that we couldn't go to that place if we see that there's an impacted supply well, but we just can't find any open active source. Then we might look at some closed site that closed a while ago. But that isn't really, you know, right now we're prioritizing what we're going after.
Thank you.
Letty.
This is horrifying. This is really scary. I'm just wondering what is the state government taking measures, and or is it just like each water board's people are working on this? I mean, this is really scary.
So I think that there is good news in the fact that a lot of legislation is trying to turn off the tap right now. So a lot of legislation to remove PFAS from consumer products that are sold within California. So the firefighting foam is one example. There's another piece of legislation that's been signed into legislation about cosmetics. So as of 2025, PFAS should not be in any cosmetics sold in California. So I think turning off the tap is a big thing that is being done statewide. And a lot of, we've actually taken our leads from the state water board. So it is, the investigations are being managed at a regional level, but the state water board was the one to initiate all of those PFAS investigations to say, hey, let's look to see, let's look at places where we think that there could be high concentrations. So let's look at airports and landfills and chrome platers and bulk fuel terminals. Let's start there. And they kind of wrote a template for us to take and to use for other sites. So it is a very collaborative effort, and it is multi-pronged, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I understand we have a commenter relevant to Kimberly's presentation. So why don't we welcome that person now, and that may generate further questions from board members.
And it's Ken Min from Zone 7. He's their groundwater manager.
Well, thank you, Chair Hacker and member of the board. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to get a chance to speak about this very important topics. So my name is Ken Min. I'm Water Resources Manager for Zone 7 Water Agency. So we supply wholesale water to Tri-Valley area. Over a quarter million ratepayers reside in our area. And we are dealing with this PFAS issues as soon as we find out about this. So we started sampling about 5 years ago. We detected in our wells. And when state board issued the response level and notification level, we go to work right away. So that is where we started. So just to give you a little bit of perspective, I'm sitting here listening to strategic plans and all the report that you are receiving. I come to realize that you are looking at the region-wide statistics and high-level information that it is a little bit higher level than what we are dealing with at the ground level. So I'd like to give you a little perspective on what that means to us. The plume that we are dealing with is about 6.5 miles long and 3 miles wide. It is not a common solvent site or, you know, decreaser site or TCUPC site. It is from ranging from Pleasanton all the way to Dublin, a little more, and it's as wide as 3 miles. So our water agencies depends on, actually Tri-Valley resident depends on groundwater, particularly during drought. For example, the second or third year of the drought, we'll be dependent on groundwater about 50% of the supplies. And Tri-Valley is very robust, economically vibrant region with the Livermore wide regions that everybody knows. So water supply reliability and resilience is extremely important for us. So people depend on it. So as far as Zone 7 goes, when we detect the PFAS, let me back up a step. According to the EPA's regulation today, adopted MCLs, EPA requires water agencies to start testing it from now to 3 years. And then the MCO become effective 5 years from approximately today. And state board response level is 40 parts per trillion for that two common compound that Kimberly just presented. But MCO is at 4 parts per trillion. So if you are residents of our service area, we can say that, well, we are meeting state board requirements at 40 parts per trillion, whereas EPA already established the fact that 4 parts per trillion is MCL. So as Zone 7 as a water agency, we take action to deliver the water to our customer, which meet the EPA requirements, not 5 years from today. Today, we are delivering the water which meets 4 parts per trillion requirement today. So it is so important for us. For example, when PFHHS response level came out 2 years ago, it's the third year of the drought. we have to shut down a well because we are detecting above that level right away. That well provides about 16% of the capacity that we have to deliver. So you can imagine how difficult it is for water agency to scramble and try to find a replacement water for that. So as of today, we are currently developing or completed the PFAS treatment facility using the ion exchange resin technique at the one of the well, one of the key wells that we put in, we have. And we are currently building another facilities that cost $35 million. The first one cost $16 million. And we are already starting to conceptualize the plan for other wells that will come in. We have to install that well treatment facility in coming years. So you can imagine the capital intensive nature of this approach is very difficult for us to manage. And I'd like to thank particularly the executive officer and the regional board team for the last 3 years have been amazing, because normally we look at regional boards and then as the water board as a regulator, regulating the requirements. But I think the paradigm has shifted since Sigma got adopted, and also the when this new leadership of executive officer, we are seeing the change in the way that board conduct their business. In addition to regulating, it's become part of our partner and collaborator for dealing with this global issues. I think I appreciate executive officers and the team for contributing to that collaboration. I really appreciate that. And I know that the state board and regional board has the resource challenges and all other limitations, but among all those things, because of the gravity of this issue, not just for the Tri-Valley area, also in Santa Clara, also in Alameda County, Water District area, all of these things, it is so important for us to receive your support and continuing participation and collaboration for dealing with this issue. And so far, when I request, actually the staff and the executive officer supported us to secure the state Sigma implementation grants. We were able to receive $16 million. It wouldn't have been possible without support and validation from the regional board that we need to have that treatments in place. So thank you so much for Eileen's and the team. And also I'd like to request your attention and your direction to the staff to continue collaborate with us, particularly with this. I will ask you one ask, which is receiving from not just from us as Zone 7 water agencies, also from the community advocates, city council, elected officials. They all asking Dr. Gantha question, where does it come from? What is the source? So we did prepare the source assessment report with our own fund to hire the consultant, prepare the report. We share that with the staff. So staff is using that report as a document to study, jumping off point to investigate those sources. That has to continue. The more important thing is that, like I said, it's 6.5 mile long and 3 mile wide plume we are currently dealing with. We're gonna deal with it as we go along with the wellhead treatments and what, and we have our own PFAS management strategy we are implementing. So we will do that. But what will really help us is that preventing from continuing or ongoing discharges. If it is a legacy plume, that's a one way that we can deal with. But if it is active plume or active sources still exist, our efforts, it is a wash. Whatever we do to clean up and help will be replenished or replaced by continuing this. That is a major concern that we have, our board has, elected officials in our region has. So I really like to get your attention and continued support for your help in dealing with this issue. Again, thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. Then I have to go to Sacramento now. but I really like to invite the board and the executive officer to come down to our valley, and so that we can show you exactly what PFAS treatments and management looks like at the ground level. And we'd like to invite you to even hold the board meetings, our boardroom. We have a really fabulous boardroom you can use take advantage of. And then staff to come and visit us. And we would love to take you guys for a tour. And I won't ask what you do after the tour. You can go to a wine country or taste it. That's not my business. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. We really appreciate hearing from you and understanding what implementation looks like as you deliver water safe to your customer base. There may be questions and comments from board members. Do you have a moment to speak?
Of course, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I just want to thank you so much for being here. My first thought was, well, what are they doing in the Tri-Valley where we drink so much groundwater? And just as a follow-up question, recharge is really important to you guys.
Correct.
Now, are there PFAS in the recharge water?
Well, we import water from seawater projects, and seawater projects' water quality currently is clean of PFAS.
Okay.
Yes.
Good.
Are there other questions?
I have a question.
Go ahead, Bill.
I want to echo what Andy just said and ask the question. It sounded from your presentation like it's not entirely clear whether this is a legacy plume or are there active sources. Are you working towards finding the answer to that question? And if there are active sources, what are the active sources? Why are the concentrations as high as they are in the Tri-Valley?
I think the board member Kissinger, I think you hit the nail here. That is where we run into our limitation. Zone 7 as a water agency, we are the basin manager, groundwater assessing for the agency. We have authority endowed by the SGMA. But we do not have, for example, warrant authority like state regional board to investigate, demand, or require the data submission. We are the basin manager. We manage the water quality for the sustainability. But however, our authorities are limited. So that's why we need to leverage your authority and your mandate to be able to investigate and prevent future releases. I think that is where we really need to partner with this regional board and make it effective. And it's nice to look at the regional levels and statistic, but when you really come visit us, and for example, if you really look into our situation, we're not unique, by the way. Other sister agencies are dealing with a similar situation, but we happen to be one of the largest. And I'm proud to say that your region two are working with this, staff and with the support, with the funding that we receive. We are the first agency in Northern California. We put in this PFAS treatment facility to use as one of the leading agencies in there managing the PFAS. So that is where the issue is, Dr. Kissinger, because we don't have the authority to investigate, and state board, region board does.
Can
yeah.
you stay for
and maybe moment? A question maybe a question that Kimberly or Alec, then, are we doing some investigation to identify potentially responsible parties here?
Yeah, yes, certainly in light of this 3-mile-long plume, we've just discussed internally, how to accelerate and prioritize the triage type investigations to find out if we have active sources. And we'll be doing that later this month, and then we'll have a list of the priority sites, and then we'll be strategizing on what kind of requirements, directives to get out there. And my hope is, I personally want to see data coming in, in before the end of this year, for sure, to answer that question.
Thank you.
I'm not going to be And one more thing that I just want to mention is we are focusing on industrial sources here, but there's been a sewer shed study that's been done to figure out what the influence to the public, to the wastewater treatment plants are, and how much PFAS is coming into the wastewater treatment plants. And it was a limited study, but initial results show that the residential component of wastewater actually has a great deal of PFAS. So that's something that's not necessarily directly within our control, but hopefully through controlling the PFAS in consumer products, that's gonna eventually decrease the PFAS that comes from our residential flows as well.
Thank you. Let me turn to Board Tom Lee.
I just have a suggestion for maybe us not to answer today, but to think about, we have in the past several years on occasion put together a board committee of just two people that can help do some of the work, do site visits, do some of the, help elevate the conversation. This seems like maybe it's one of those topics where and this is intended to be sort of a short-term push of a couple of board members to provide support and exposure and influence. So I just throw it out to Eileen, yourself, and Alexis to maybe think about whether this might be an opportunity. We did it with climate. We did it on stormwater. So maybe this is one of those topics. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me turn to Dr. Mumley.
Yeah, thank you. I want to just add to the dialogue and emphasize, I'm going to boast in a sense, boast in the general we context, we have been a leader in this issue, primarily through our regional monitoring program for many years. We started monitoring for PFAS in the Bay in the late 2000s. So we have data from going back to 2009. So it's been a high priority part of our regional monitoring program, and it continues to be. So I want to point out a few things that we've learned. It's everywhere. Unfortunately, it is everywhere. So we have generated one of the few data sets regarding the presence of PFAS in urban stormwater. It's everywhere. And we're going to expand that effort through the regional monitoring program. We've also continued to expand and adapt our ongoing monitoring of PFAS in the Bay. It's now a standard component of our status and trends program. So not only do we know it's present, but we're trying to better understand trends, et cetera, particularly as we see regrettable replacements. That's a big part of the challenge, right? Is that there's thousands of these compounds, and there are already replacements that are as problematic as the PFOS and PFOA that we've talked about. Kimberly mentioned one of the efforts that was stimulated by the state board asking publicly owned treatment works around the state about the presence of PFAS in their effluent, influent, biosolids. And because of our collaborative relationship with the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies and via our efforts for the Regional Monitoring Program, we entertained and got the state board to approve an alternative approach where we did more of a special study rather than just having everybody monitor and then decide how we're going to interpret data. We developed a focused study that's more representative and went deeper in terms of presence in effluent, influent, as well as in the sewer sheds themselves. And as Kimberly pointed out, the unfortunate reality is they're everywhere, and there's not just these unique industrial sources, although they do exist. One of the highest levels observed in the sewer shed monitoring came from an industrial laundry facility. And but guess where that's coming from? Clothes have a lot of PFAS in them. So the bad news is they're everywhere. The good news is that we, in conjunction with our sister agencies, have made this a super high priority. A couple of things I'll bring to your attention is our sister agency, the Department of Toxic Substance Control, through its Safer Consumer Product Program, has made PFAS a high priority, and they're the cause for ongoing efforts now, challenging industry to demonstrate why they have to use these compounds and whether or not they're safer alternatives. We've helped fuel that by generating data about the presence of PFAS in the Bay and in urban creeks, and we'll continue to do so. To that end, we, through the Estuary Institute, with partnership, secured a multi-million dollar grant from the San Francisco Bay Improvement Fund, and that's called Sources to Solutions, and it's all about going upstream in within our watersheds as well as our sewer sheds to get a better handle as to where are the significant sources coming from, and doing this in partnership with the DTSC Safer Consumer Product Program to help fuel their efforts to engage with industry for certain those most important products. Our sister agency, the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, OEHA, is actually actively developing a risk threshold for PFAS in fish. So we have observed levels of PFAS in fish that are a concern. They're around or approaching levels that have been identified in other parts of, like at the Great Lakes, they have a working number that, of a concern level for PFAS. Not surprising, our levels are comparable. So there's a lot going on and a lot more to happen. We did a synthesis of all our PFAS work through the regional monitoring program in 2018. And this year, actually, we put funding towards updating that. So by it'll take about a year to compile it all, but there'll be some working information that we'll be presenting at the regional monitoring program annual meeting this coming fall. So what else can I tell you that's going on? So as far as our permitted wastewater and stormwater entities, we do have requirements in the wastewater permits as well as the municipal regional stormwater permit to monitor for emerging contaminants, including PFAS. Sometimes the concept of emerging contaminant emerging concern is somewhat of a misnomer because we've been concerned for a long time. They tend to be under-regulated contaminants of concern, but they meet their monitoring requirements by augmenting their contribution to the regional monitoring program. So the regional monitoring program now is putting a substantial proportion of its budget augmented by the BACWAT and the municipal stormwater resources to do a lot more and continue to do more monitoring of various emerging contaminants in addition to PFAS. But PFAS, like I said, is a high priority.
That was so helpful. And thank you so much for coming. I'm sure we will take you up on your kind offer of a tour. Please. Within Bagley-Keene Act requirements, we might have two board members able to come and tour and report back to the board, and then we can see, working with our executive officer, what would be the most constructive option. Should we have a subcommittee or should we do something that complements what our staff is doing? I want to thank Kimberly as well and her team for an excellent presentation. Katie, thank you for your presentation. I know it wasn't uplifting in terms of our deeper understanding of contamination, but it is a reminder of how important this work is. And I, in particular, wanted to thank you for complimenting our staff and management team for their partnership and collaboration. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Please do come visit. Thank you.
Thank you. Very well. Is there anyone else present who wants to comment on items 7 or 8? Am I missing someone on the board? No? Very well. We're going to take a lunch break and we're going to have a closed session. And so to give you some sense of timing, I think it's now about 11:30. If board members could be ready to start our closed session upstairs at 15:45. And I could let our support team and the ADP folks know not to expect us for at least 1 hour and 15 minutes. We'll need at least that much time. The webcast and court reporting will be stopped. We'll reconvene here in this conference room after the closed session, at which point I will simply be adjourning the meeting. Let me turn to counsel.
Thank you, Chair Hacker. So we're going into closed session. We have to specify which closed session we're going into. So we're going into closed session for item 12, the first bullet item, which is the Sweeney versus the Water Board case. And then the second is the second City and County of California, City and County of San Francisco versus the United States and the State of California. That's the third bulleted item.
It is. Thank you.
And I really if I could just say that.
Go ahead, Bill.
If I could say a quick word. Yeah, I am going to recuse myself from the discussion of the City and County of San Francisco because of work that I do for the City and County of San Francisco.
Understood. So we will start with the first bulleted item, Sweeney, and then we will take a couple minute break and board member Kissinger will log off. After we return to this room, we will just be having a moment of closing remarks and adjournment. So at the earliest, 1 p.m. Thank you, everyone. meeting. We have just concluded our closed session, and there are no announcements from the closed session. I want to, in closing out today's meeting, I wanted to thank the staff who've supported this meeting. I want to thank the regional board managers and staff who made such excellent presentations this morning. I thank our terrific ADP team that have made this hybrid broadcast possible. And this concludes the public session of the May 8th, 2024 San Francisco Bay Water Board meeting. There was no correspondence received. Thank you all for joining us. We appreciate your engagement with us. Our next meeting is scheduled for June 12th, 2024. We'll be returning to our normal habitat in the auditorium here in the Elihu Harris building. That concludes our meeting. Thank you.